You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's a little after 10 o'clock, and now a feature in which playwright Mark Ravenhill considers what exactly are we celebrating as we mark Shakespeare's 450th anniversary. He asks actors, directors and playwrights to reflect on Shakespeare for and against.
I must have been about 7 years old when I came home from the library carrying a massive volume. "What's that book?" laughed my mum. "It's almost bigger than you." It was the complete works of Shakespeare. I was a keen reader. My particular favourite at the time was the C.S. Lewis Narnia books. But somebody, I can't remember who, had told me that Shakespeare was the greatest writer of all time. Leafing through the pages of the book, I was dismayed to find that these strange words were impenetrable. And then I found the first scene of Macbeth, The Witches. I started to read their words, part nursery rhyme, part spell, over and over again, until I'd learnt them. When shall we three meet again, in thunder, lightning, or in rain? When the hurly-burly's done, when the battle's lost or won, that will be ere the set of sun. Where's the place upon the heath there to meet with Macbeth? I've come to Springhead Primary School, just outside of Stoke-on-Trent. They're marking Shakespeare Week. The school hall is filling up with 9 and 10-year-olds here for a first encounter with Shakespeare, a visiting production of Taming of the Shrew by the Royal Shakespeare Company.
What's your favourite character?
Kate.
Kate? Really? Was she so mean to her sister?
I'm used to it.
Oh, really? Have you got a sister?
Brothers.
Brothers, uh-oh.
These students are much younger than I was when I saw my first full-length Shakespeare play. That would have been when I was 14, a touring production, again by the RSC, of Henry IV.
Good morrow, Kate. For that's your name, I hear.
Well, you heard. But something hard of hearing. They call me Catherine, that you talk of me.
You lie in faith, for you are called plain Kate.
For the last 2 years, I was playwright in residence at the RSC, spending a lot of time reading and watching Shakespeare and thinking about what it is that's made him, in a country that is today so suspicious of any religious or political beliefs, a sort of secular god.
Aye, it's the fool who can find it where it lies.
Oh, who knows not where a wasp does where his sting? In his tail?
In his tongue?
Whose tongue?
Yours, if you talk of tails, and so farewell.
What, with my tongue in your tail?
Oh!
So what will these young people make of the performance? Will they engage with and enjoy the play?
Good Kate, I am a gentleman.
That I'll try.
Or are they being induced, before they're too old to question it, into the cult of Shakespeare? Or are the two things now so entangled that you can't have one without the other? Why do so many of us, including me, enjoy Shakespeare so much? The actress, Fiona Shaw, has played many of Shakespeare's leading roles, everything from Rosalind in As You Like It to the title character in Richard II.
Peter Brook had said, "It's not what you do to the language, it's what the language does to you." Well, it really did do something to me. I felt it literally expanded my mind. I felt I was brainier at the end of it. I played Portia and Beatrice, and people used to tell me how intelligent I was. I thought, no, I'm not. They are, or the words are, and if you can dance with the words, you sort of borrow the intelligence of them. Rosalind says huge arcs of sentences, like, "No, no, Orlando, men are April when they woo, December when they wed, maids are May when it is May, but the sky changes when they are wives." I mean, he's genius. Every character speaks slightly differently, even though on the page it looks quite formal.
"Now we have divided in three our kingdom, and 'tis our fast intent to shake all cares and business from our age, conferring them on younger strengths while we, unburdened, crawl toward death."
Simon Russell Beale, who's played more of the great Shakespeare roles than any other actor of his generation and is currently playing Lear at the National Theatre, shares Fiona's sense that Shakespeare somehow makes us bigger than we are.
When you get to the end of especially the great tragedies, I do think he has a sort of spooky ability to expand a particular situation out to include everybody. So when you see the end of Lear, or you see the end of Othello, or you see the end of Hamlet, you do have the sense that he's I don't know what it is. I can't put my finger on how he does it, but he seems to expand it out. You do feel at the end as if you are standing alone on stage as the essence of being a human being. It sounds outrageously pretentious, but that's what it feels like.
Yeah, it always feels like that from the audience as well.
Yeah, and I think the same with Lear. You know, Lear coming on with his dead daughter is like the summation of every pain that's ever existed about the death of children, grief.
When I attended a British Council Shakespeare seminar in Berlin a couple of months ago, I was struck by the vocabulary that many of us reached for as we tried to describe our appreciation of Shakespeare. He's universal, we said. He's timeless. He seems to understand every part of human nature. He judges no one, forgives everything. He's beyond any ideology. But surely these are words that we use when we describe a deity. With the decline of Christianity, I suggested to Royal Shakespeare Company artistic director Gregory Doran, who was educated at a Catholic school, hasn't Shakespeare in some way become a replacement for God?
Well, I suppose when I went to university and I came out, it was like tugging the card at the bottom of the house of cards and realising that my church disagreed with my sexuality. And at that point, I recognised what Sartre calls the God-shaped hole in my consciousness. And I suspect I have filled that with Shakespeare. Mm. And in a way, I think it's a better fit.
And I think the culture has.
I think the culture has too. I think because he explores almost every kind of element of human experience with a kind of compassion and humanity that is not always there in the Bible. You sometimes read the book of Leviticus and think it should be torn out of the Bible for the prejudice that it has allowed over the years, where you would never find that in Shakespeare.
But at that same Berlin conference, I was also struck, after initial declarations of Shakespeare's genius, with the reservations that would creep in. He's all forgiving. Oh, apart from The Merchant of Venice, someone would say, that's plain anti-Semitic, or The Taming of the Shrew probably shouldn't be produced because of its cruel subjugation of Kate. None of his jokes are actually funny, somebody offered, while a good number suggested that the plays weren't actually stage-worthy but were better read than seen and heard. There's something contradictory about our attitude to the greatest writer of all time. Working on a production of Troilus and Cressida in 2012, I was struck by the poisonous bitterness of the play, its jagged inconsistencies, its utter nihilism.
The common curse of mankind, folly and ignorance, be thine in great revenue. Heaven bless thee from a tutor and discipline, come not near thee. Let thy blood be thy direction until thy death. Then if she that lays thee out says thou art a fair corpse, I'll be sworn and sworn upon. She never shrouded any but Lazars.
It's a good play, but shows little evidence of an understanding forgiving Shakespeare. In this play at least, he seems to hate more than he forgives. Shakespeare's place in our culture is both central and secure. But at which point did he stop being the writer of some of the most popular plays on the Elizabethan stage and become a national and international icon? How did he become a figure whose shortcomings could be so easily overlooked? Shakespeare's ascendancy began in his own lifetime, suggests Dr. Martin Wiggins, Professor of Post-Reformation Dramatic Literature at the University of Birmingham's Shakespeare Institute.
Shakespeare is not only a writer, but also an actor and a shareholder in the company that puts on his plays. Now, that's quite rare. A person with power has a different relationship with celebrity from a person who merely has talent, because the person with power is able to influence whether another writer's play gets bought and produced. And so, naturally, people have an incentive to praise that person. I'm not saying that Shakespeare is unworthily praised. I'm saying that some of the praise for Shakespeare might have been for the wrong reasons.
A writer, then, wielding more power within his own time than other writers. But was there a clear moment when Shakespeare became a national icon? Why not another great Elizabethan dramatist, Christopher Marlowe or Ben Jonson?
In the 18th century, Britain felt that it needed a national poet, a poet of empire that could be the same for Britain as Virgil had been for the Roman Empire. So there was an issue of who do we choose? Do we choose Marlowe? subversive Christopher Marlowe, who worked as a spy and who ended up being murdered in an eating house in Deptford. Marlowe is not a very good candidate for an establishment figure in the way that, say, Ben Jonson could be. Problems with Ben Jonson as well. For 11 years or so, he was a Catholic. Not a good thing in the 18th century.
But it was the actor David Garrick who firmly established Shakespeare as the national poet. Professor Michael Dobson, also of the Shakespeare Institute.
When David Garrick puts together the first great Shakespeare fan festival in 1769, the Stratford Jubilee, it's an event which, for the first time, puts up a public statue and makes an enormous fuss of somebody who's a commoner, somebody who is supposed to have in some way created themselves and made an enormous international mark purely by their own ingenuity. Shakespeare is a romantic writer, as somebody who is more invested in individuality than in the classical rules. That sells hugely in Germany. You know, Germans hear about the Jubilee and they think, yeah, if we're going to have a national literature that's going to assert our independence from French classicism, then Shakespeare is the way forward. And he's very soon translated and adopted as essentially a German classic in translation. This idea of a kind of middle-class artisan creativity that's individual and eccentric and emotional is something that catches on across the rest of Europe, and eventually even the French catch up. And it's as a romantic writer that Shakespeare gets internationalised after that.
Today it's hard to think of any substantial figure who would stand up and suggest that Shakespeare is actually a bad writer. We seem to have reached a consensus that Shakespeare is great.
Shakespeare's fundamental principle is that the end justifies the means.
But that hasn't always been the case.
Action at all cost, the absence of all ideals, moderation in everything, the conservation of the forms of life once established, and the end justifying the means. If you add to this a chauvinist English patriotism, expressed in all the historical dramas, a patriotism according to which the English throne is something sacred, Englishmen always vanquishing the French, killing thousands and losing only scores, Joan of Arc regarded as a witch, and the belief that Hector and all the Trojans from whom the English came are heroes while the Greeks are cowards and traitors and so forth. Such is the view of the wisest teacher of life.
It's easy to laugh at the indignation, but that was actually Leo Tolstoy writing at the end of the 19th century with the great achievements of Anna Karenina and War and Peace behind him. Two works that are surely as great as much of Shakespeare. So it's worth giving some thought to such a great writer's objections, if only to remind ourselves that it was once possible to question Shakespeare. And Tolstoy isn't alone. There's a considerable intellectual lineage of writers and thinkers, from Voltaire through to Wittgenstein, who've raised serious questions about Shakespeare's genius. One of Michael Dobson's colleagues, Ewan Ferney.
Tolstoy hated Shakespeare. Bernard Shaw did too, and he said that it would be... He sometimes gets so frustrated with Shakespeare that he'd like to dig him up and throw stones at him. Tolstoy had a fierce and more serious animus against Shakespeare. In particular, he homes in on King Lear, and he has an extended analysis of one of the hovel scenes. Those scenes are impossible, and that is their interest and vitality. They're impossible because they're full of nonsense, obscenity, disconnection.
Poor naked wretches, wheresoe'er you are, that bide the pelting of this pitiless storm. How shall your houseless heads and unfed sides, your looped and windowed raggedness, defend you from seasons such as these? Oh, I have ta'en too little care of this. Take physic, pomp. Expose thyself to feel what wretches feel, that thou mayst shake the superflux to them and show the heavens more just.
Tolstoy, who at that point wants to change the world, wants to make it a better place, thinks it's a disgusting capitulation to corruption. So he sees that in Shakespeare's language, it's uncontrolled, it's accommodationist, it just says everything. And he sees it in terms of Shakespeare's morality. There is no morality. It's simply the world as it is, and therefore it has no moral dignity. It has no moral authority, and we should not admire it.
For Tolstoy, who believed that a form of religious belief was the only way that humanity could live in the approaching 20th century, it was Shakespeare's lack of faith that made him a bad writer. So many of the things that we see as Shakespeare's strengths, his ability to accommodate all perspectives, his lack of a coherent worldview, were the very things that Tolstoy saw as failings. And there was, he suggested, a certain circularity that served to keep Shakespeare in his place as the world's greatest writer.
To give the greater force to their praise of the whole of Shakespeare, they invented aesthetic theories, according to which it appeared that no definite religious view of life was necessary for works of art in general, and especially for the drama. That for the purpose of the drama, the representation of human passions and characters was quite sufficient. That not only was an internal religious illumination of what was represented unnecessary, but art should be objective. That it should represent events quite independently of any judgment of good and evil. As these theories were founded on Shakespeare's own views of life, it naturally turned out that the works of Shakespeare satisfied these theories and therefore were the height of perfection.
And that seems to me to be the most persuasive part of Tolstoy's argument, that we've used Shakespeare to define what great art is, and so we see in him great art. Shakespeare is so saturated in our culture that we're no longer in a position to assess how good, bad, or great he is. We can't gain sufficient distance from which to criticise him, and that we're now likely to reject other possibly equally great writing because it doesn't conform to our Shakespeare model. Shakespeare may be a great writer, but is his dominance closing our minds to other patterns of thought, ways of shaping our experience? Professor Gary Taylor from Florida State University suggests that today Shakespeare has become such an overwhelming force in our culture that he's a star which has become a black hole.
Shakespeare, in his own time, was an enormously creative and inspiring figure who illuminated parts of human experience that nobody had done before. But as Shakespeare became more and more the monarch of English literature, which Thomas Carlyle said in the 19th century, then everybody wanted their own interpretation of Shakespeare. Everybody wanted to control the king. And so you've developed a huge industry, both theatrical and educational, which is about figuring out Shakespeare and what he means and why he's important. You have all of these theater artists, painters, filmmakers, literary critics, scholars, who have poured their own energies into Shakespeare. But he's no longer telling us something that is his idea, his thought. We are pouring our thoughts into his works and saying that's what Shakespeare meant. So he sucks in creativity, whereas in earlier centuries, he was radiating energy and activity.
It would be nice to think that we could go back to a point where we could engage with Shakespeare's plays simply for what they are, but there's no turning back. We now engage with both the plays and Shakespeare the icon.
We're now in the shop at the Royal Shakespeare Company.
And Shakespeare the brand.
We've got some baby bibs. What's this one?
Though she be but little, she is fierce, from A Midsummer Night's Dream, on a very cute pink onesie for a small baby.
Dr. Erin Sullivan, author of Olympic Shakespeare and the Idea of Legacy.
Sometimes there's this sense with branding, we use it so broadly to mean the experience of things and the value, economic but also cultural and intellectual, that we ascribe to things, sometimes without actually experiencing them. So there's been a long-standing desire to keep art separate from money. Culture is one thing and commodity and commerce is another. And I think that that's created a false distinction that in turn has made us really suspicious and critical when we start to see places in which we have to acknowledge that culture and commerce are coming together. And then we can sometimes then be really skeptical and reject that cultural form or say that it's all a sham.
And what about within academia? Does Shakespeare distort the funding economy of what you can write about? Is it easier to get something funded if you focus on Shakespeare?
I think it is, to be honest. I do know people who work on sort of different parts of 17th century literature and who have been told, oh, if you could make the chapter that's on the Shakespeare restoration adaptations more prominent throughout the book, then we might be able to publish it. So again, we maybe sometimes think of academia as hopefully separate from economic concerns, but it isn't.
Perhaps then to re-engage with Shakespeare, to put some space between the plays and the myth and the marketing, we have to acknowledge his weaknesses alongside celebrating his strengths. Fiona Shaw and Simon Russell Beale again.
I've just had a long period of rehearsing King Lear, which unquestionably is a masterpiece. It's absolutely dazzling. But there are things, famously, there's a thing about the fact that a major character, the fool, disappears halfway through the play and is not mentioned again until right at the very end when the old king who's dying himself says, oh, my poor fool is hanged. And there's ways of arguing that as being a brilliant piece of playwriting, but I actually think it's probably not. You can't drop a major character halfway through a play and just not tell anybody where he's gone. Again, another absence in Hamlet. Hamlet disappears after the third act, so sort of three-quarters of the way through the play, comes back a different person. And I alternate between thinking that's a stroke of genius to see the major character go on, obviously an experience that changes his life, and thinking it's a missed opportunity.
I've heard many of my colleagues say they want to speak about what it is to be human, other than about which man you should end up in. And Shakespeare gives this language, which is so empowering to the intellect, to many men. I definitely feel that someone like me might have continued on at the Royal Shakespeare Company had there been more for me to do. But inevitably, once I'd eaten and drunk all the roles for women that were good, I have to move on. But the male actor does get this chance to flex their muscles. Simon or Rafe, or, you know, they're just playing them every few years. It really is a huge inequality. But it's nobody's fault, it's just the cultures.
Can we really claim, as we so often do, that Shakespeare captures all human experience when his plays and the theatre of his time filled the stage with so many men and so few women? By constantly producing Shakespeare, aren't we in danger of continuing to overvalue male experience and of perpetuating the silences around the female experience? Phyllida Lloyd recently directed an all-female company in Julius Caesar at the Donmar Theatre in London. She was surprised at the vehemence of the response when she suggested that a permanent ensemble of actors performing Shakespeare today should be equally divided between men and women.
When I mentioned that I felt that had I the reins or the keys, I'd be just taking 50% men, 50% women, and then saying, OK, how are we going to work out our season? This seemed to be, was considered very incendiary. It seemed to me really quite fundamental. Of course, there is a problem that you have a play like Julius Caesar, which has nearly 40 characters and only two of them are female. If you say, well, that means we've got to have two women in our company and 40 men, it just doesn't seem to me acceptable. And I'm quite convinced that were Shakespeare alive now, he'd be going, guys, get over yourselves.
For which he suffered death. Here comes his body, mourned by Mark Antony, who, though he had no hand in his death, shall receive the benefit of his dying. A place in the Commonwealth, as which of you shall not. With this I depart,
that as I slew my best lover for the good of Rome, I have the same dagger for myself when it shall please my country to need my death.
Now, he was, of course, working in a theatre where it was unthinkable to have women on stage.
Erica Wyman, Deputy Artistic Director of the RSC.
So naturally that comes through, and I think you're right that we have a legacy of assuming the perfect play has four women in and 16 men. That's problematic, that we haven't got over the form. Actually, American television drama has probably got further than we have on the British stage, which is a great shame.
We've sort of marginalised ourselves by going, there are only two roles for women in Julius Caesar. I think Shakespeare would be shocked if he saw all the actresses around today and their capabilities and thought, for goodness sake, why, you know, you've only got them in those two roles. That's not how these, you know, these plays are a much less naturalistic event, that somehow the character and the poetry and the actor all exist as separate things. You're seeing the real Brutus, you're seeing the actor playing Brutus, and his poetic, his sort of existential musings, all separate, and they're all being refracted, bounced one off the other, and to try to turn them into a sort of cohesive, natural thing where boys are boys and girls are girls and we all wear costumes of the 1930s, that seems to me the most reductive.
Phyllida Lloyd's notion of the character and the poetry and the actor existing alongside but separate from each other is for me a brilliant image of the way that Shakespeare's theatre works when we produce it well, and a reminder that too many of our contemporary productions are restricted by our reverence for Shakespeare, the icon and marketable product. Simon Russell Beale.
Again and again when you rehearse Shakespeare plays, you're sort of sellotaping the plays together to try and cover up inconsistencies or ambiguities. And some of those ambiguities are great, and you think, embrace them. And some of them you think, no, that's just sloppy writing.
That's what I always find quite funny about a Shakespeare rehearsal process. Often everybody on the first day says, marvellous, marvellous, marvellous. And then there's a sort of other language going on during rehearsal of finding all the flaws.
Over the last 100 years, it's recognised that these texts aren't set. And I think that releases us to respond to him in whichever way we wish. The danger of him being so well-known and so famous and having been here for 400 years, you know, a lot of the parts, even without us recognising it, have become layered over with a certain amount of assumptions, Hamlet being a very obvious one. Mm. As I say, because the texts aren't canonical anymore, I think that's given us licence to do that.
And we're not making full use of that licence.
I think we could go further, yeah. I think I'm as guilty as anybody of this, of doing straight Shakespeare.
Royal Shakespeare Company Artistic Director Gregory Doran.
I think the danger is it becomes sacrosanct. You know, I think in a way it's partially why productions and interpretations in other languages are much freer. There's an Italian proverb that says, traditori, traduttori, translators, traitors. But actually, if you're freed from, as it were, the necessity to deliver the language, then you are freer to interpret the themes as they hit you or regard you.
I now do feel that it's possible for me not to see a Shakespeare play, because I'm not sure what I will learn from it. So it means that someone's got to come to the play and actually wallop it off the stage for me to hear it. I can't hear it if it sounds like a tune of the culture I'm in.
A bored slave, which any print of goodness wilt not take, being capable of all ill. I pitied thee, took pains to make thee speak, taught thee each hour one thing or other. When thou didst not, savage, know thine own meaning, but wouldst gabble like a thing most brutish, I endowed thy purposes with words that made them known. But thy
Miranda from The Tempest, a play which has been much discussed for its resonance in post-colonial studies. Shakespeare was never universal, of course, due to genius alone. In much of the world, he arrived as part of empire, used to teach both English language and a set of British values. But author of Shakespeare, Race and Colonialism, Anya Lumbar of Pennsylvania State University, believes the relationship between coloniser and colonised was much more complex. Was there anything particularly about Indian culture that made it receptive to Shakespeare?
These are difficult questions, because even if something is imposed, it can be appropriated and made to speak a different language. Even though Shakespeare might have been first imposed as part of colonial education, it was appropriated and made to speak, for example, against colonialism. And performed on the stage, it was mixed up with Indian theatrical forms, mixed up with local idioms. And what you got at the end was a very different kind of Shakespeare to the one that maybe colonialists intended.
And you speak about one of those ways of appropriating and almost overturning was that the teaching of Shakespeare did introduce or further an idea of nationalism.
Yes. In Calcutta, for example, in what was called Hindu College, they were young nationalists and they had been taught Shakespeare, and they used Shakespeare to argue that all people are equal. Indians did begin to use The Tempest to argue that Caliban's colonization was wrong. This is not something they got from the classroom, obviously. This is something they got by fusing their study of Shakespeare with real life lived experience. So I think it's important to remember that Shakespeare became something else in the colonies.
And yet here the Tempest is still being used for jingoistic purposes, notably during the London 2012 Olympics opening ceremony.
It was frightening, because that's